And hey guys, I think today Dave Rubin is my first three-peat. Is that, can you confirm that, Dave?
I believe if I was to check the record, and I do check the record every morning, the records that are out there.
You are number one.
I am now the first three-peat guest for Dr. Gadsad. I'm very excited. Well, you've been on my show like 87 times, so, you know, the least you could do, man.
Which, by the way, I have a little beef with you to pick because your new book is out next week. Well, not your first book is out next week. Don't burn this book behind you, inconspicuously behind you. It was an accident that it's there. So
complete accident.
I noticed in the acknowledgments, of course, what I was expecting is to my mentor and hero, Professor Dr. Gadsad. I look there expecting this. I see to Ben Affleck. Explain yourself, sir.
Well, I sense, my friend, that you know where I'm going with this already. And for the record, because again, the record is very important, you are mentioned in the book several times and quoted several times, and I tell a little bit about your story and all that good stuff. And it's kind of funny because I did have to sort of balance. You know, I've met so many interesting people and thinkers and philosophers and writers and economists and comedians and all that. And many of them have affected me usually positively, some of them negatively, some of them I've come to like, some of them I've come to dislike, whatever it may be. But I did have to sort of blend who I'm going to kind of write about here and there and the whole other thing. Anyway, so yes, the book is dedicated to Ben Affleck. And as you know, because when you were literally the first guest on the first test show of the Rubin Report, so technically you were my first guest ever as an interview show. We talked about this. There's the infamous moment from about 5 years ago when Ben Affleck was sitting on the panel side of the table at Real Time with Bill Maher, meaning he was one of the three guests doing sort of the hot topics thing. And then they brought on this mild-mannered neuroscientist who was there to talk about spirituality without religion, his book Waking Up, which I had right over there. And yes, by the way, The Consuming Instinct is right over there by Gadsad as well. But Sam Harris, who I had never heard of, by the way, it was literally the first time I had ever seen this man or heard of this man. I had never read any of his books or any of that, was sitting there with Bill Maher. And I know that most of your audience obviously knows this show, this story, so I'll tell it very briefly. They started talking about really how you have to be able to separate ideas from people. So, of course, you should be able to criticize any set of ideas, whether it's a religious set of ideas, the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Quran, anything else, whether it's a political party set of ideas, whether it's a sports rule set of ideas, whatever it may be, you have to criticize ideas. But if you criticize the rules of basketball, it doesn't mean you hate all basketball players. And if you criticize the Old Testament, it certainly doesn't mean that you hate all Jews. And what it was whittled down to was Sam explaining that if you criticize the doctrine of Islam, it doesn't mean that you're bigoted towards all Muslims. And the famous line that Affleck threw out there to Bill Maher and Sam Harris was, "You're gross and racist." And as you know, I was working at the Young Turks at the time. This is well before we knew each other, but I was a lefty. I was a progressive. I was in on that thing. And for about a year before that, I had been thinking this thing. You know, sometimes when you just have a thought rattling in your head for a while, but you can't quite piece it together to sort of really be able to verbalize it properly or really understand it. But I had been thinking this thing about how it can't be possible that all of our intellectual opponents are racists and bigots and Islamophobes, and we're so morally right about everything, and that's why we're screaming all the time and have moral, you know, righteous indignation and the rest of it, and that all of those people are so wrong and so stupid and so backwards. The equation didn't work for me anymore. And when I saw Affleck do that, and then he was pounding on the table and huffing and puffing, and, you know, people have, there's sort of an internet rumor out there that this was right before he became Batman in the DC movies, and that maybe he was, you know, on some steroids or something. I have no idea. But he was just, you know, he was all kind of jacked up. And seeing this sort of A-list movie star throw this crazy accusation on what struck me as just this decent guy who I didn't know, Sam Harris, but more importantly, actually, Bill Maher, because Bill Maher was the standard bearer of a left in American politics for the last 30 years. He's been fighting every lefty cause. The guy donated $1 million to Obama. He's a lefty's lefty lefty. But suddenly, over the next few days, I saw what we all saw, which was Vox and BuzzFeed and HuffPo and all these things suddenly saying that Bill Maher is a racist and Sam Harris is a racist. And that moment, it's one of three moments that I describe in the book of going from what I would say is woke to await. So although Affleck may not be thrilled with it, I do credit him with much of my political awakening. And by the way, there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people that have had a similar awakening because of that very moment. Our good friend Yasmin Mohammed, that was one of her seminal moments as well. So a lot of people saw that and it was just like, whoa, can we just not honestly talk about anything anymore? Is that how you do it? And you just scream at people? And that really sort of set me on the journey that brings me here today to you.
So, I mean, you discuss about that whole journey in your book, right? Do you know if Ben Affleck or any of the high profile people that either of us or our common groups of friends have gone after, if any of them have either privately or publicly stated that they've had their epiphany, or is it very difficult to move these folks?
Well, look, you know, I'm here in LA and I'm sort of, although I don't consider myself sort of like embedded in Hollywood per se, because I'm not, you know, I'm not an actor in movies or something like that. I am sort of in this world and I do, you know, I have good representation that reps a lot of these people and all of that stuff. What I can tell you is this, I mean, leftism, you know this, leftism is such an all-encompassing worldview, and collectivism and now what I would say is socialism, whatever we want to call this postmodern junket of ideas that really are very competing and don't make a lot of sense and sort of purge out everyone who thinks anything different, right? Because I know, especially for guys like us, we still have, well, I can only speak for myself, but I think for you as well, we still have some ideas that would be thought of as traditionally lefty, right?
Thank you very much, love. My round one.
The drinks have begun.
Cheers.
It's a margarita, my friend. It's a little early for me on the West Coast, but
Irish Bailey cream. Is that too wimpy? Is that wimpy or is that manly?
I mean, I've got a fruity margarita in front of me. It's all right, Gab.
Okay, sorry to interrupt you. Go on.
But so Hollywood, it's hard to describe what Hollywood is, and I don't like to think, oh, everyone in Hollywood thinks the exact same thing. What I can tell you is this. I've seen a lot of people in Hollywood that would never want their name mentioned that are breaking away from this nonsense. And one of the reasons I'm sort of enthused about the world after coronavirus, whenever that world presents itself, if it ever presents itself, I mean, we're in a really weird time right now, but is that I think celebrity is sort of dying. People, you know, you've been trapped in your house just like everybody else for the last 6 weeks. It's like, do you really care what celebrities say or think right now? I know you wouldn't normally anyway, but for the average person that might have cared before, and then these celebrities, suddenly we're seeing all these people in their house without all the studio lights, without all of the makeup, all this stuff. And it's just like, you're actually just regular people who in many cases aren't that talented, and what you think about the world isn't that important. So I think in many respects, we're going to see some of the continued crumbling of the Hollywood institution, which is good. I mean, look, before coronavirus, they couldn't even get someone to host the Oscars because the whole thing has become so politically correct that, you know, what's his name? Kevin Hart dropped out of it, right? And then it was like they couldn't even get anyone. That was the dream job of every comic 15 years ago. Right. Everybody wanted, you wanted, Billy Crystal did it every year and Robin Williams did and David Letterman did and all these guys. But everyone wanted that thing. And then because political correctness infected every part of our society, every comic was like, whoa, whoa, no. I don't want the biggest break ever because I might actually say a joke or pause at the wrong moment or slip over one word and have to deal with that insanity. So I do know, I can tell you I know some pretty popular people, like A-list type people that are starting to wake up to some of this stuff. That all being said, what I'm frustrated with is sort of the set of people that let us consistently do the dirty work on
right.
this. And fight it publicly while, you know, maybe they privately give us accolades or they privately attend parties with people that they would never associate with publicly. I know a lot of people like that. And I really can't stand that because I don't think I'm anything that special. I think I tell people what I think and I guess I'm a decent interviewer. But the idea that I'm fighting this battle so I can sort of protect the nice liberals, you know what I mean? The guys that
sure.
the guys that no longer will retweet you that maybe were your friends 3 years ago and in some ways with me as well. I'm really kind of sick of those guys. And in many ways, I'm writing this book to free them from their own self-hostage situation.
Are some of those people without, I understand you don't want to probably mention names on air, but are some of those people folks that you would have otherwise considered part of your inner intellectual circle, folks that have been on your show, that you're somehow disappointed in some of their public positions?
Yeah, but it's not exactly that I'm disappointed by their public positions. And I know what we've just done now has opened up the YouTube comment section to begin the...
who we're talking about.
Right, they're going to have their lineup and they're going to go through everybody. So it's really not about anybody specific. But I can tell you, look, I go to parties with people where then they'll be like, say, further right-leaning people than us. And it's like they're friendly with them there and then would be happy to throw them under the bus publicly. Or, you know, a lot of this, so much of it has to do with Trump, I think. And you hit this a lot on Twitter, where it's like Trump, I think, look, do I think he's some magically incredible, decent, honest, like superhuman? Of course not. What I think he is, he's a bull in a china shop. You know, the analogy I used 3 years ago after the election was we wanted a panther in a china shop, most of us. But that doesn't exist. It's called a bull in a china shop for a reason. We wanted a panther to walk in and knock off one thing and knock off something else and close the door and walk away. But that's not an analogy, right? A bull gets in there. Right. He's that guy that's doing all the dirty work. And so that all of these, let's say, moderate conservatives and decent liberals can still feel good about themselves. So they don't have to say the things that he's making happen. And I've really just become exhausted by that. I find it kind of nauseating. It doesn't mean I think he is some incredible, moral, honest person. At this point, he's a politician. And actually, there's simply no way to be an incredible, moral, honest person as a politician. But I certainly don't think he's Hitler, and I don't think he's evil. And you may have seen the video that we put up a couple days ago. David and I actually had dinner at Mar-a-Lago in December. So I had dinner at Mar-a-Lago with my husband, with Trump Jr. and Kimberly Guilfoyle. And we had a lovely time, and Trump was sitting there a few feet away from us. We met him after. When he turned to David, and he said, so Trump Jr. introduced me to him, and he said, I have this podcast, blah, blah, blah. And then he turns to David, he says, who are you? And David says, well, I'm his husband. And Trump gets up, he slaps his hands on the table, he gets up, he goes, husband? He goes, I just want you to know, I think that's great. I think it's just great, and I don't give a shit, and I don't think anyone's given a shit for 20 years. And then he turns to Melania, he says, honey, can you believe it? These guys are are married. Their only problem is they're too good looking. And then David chatted with Melania for a little bit. I chatted with Trump for a little bit, and it was perfectly fine. Now, does that make him Moses? Does that make him Jesus? No. But I think he's just doing a lot of the dirty work so that these liberals, or especially the never Trump conservatives, he's doing all the stuff that these conservatives have always wanted. He is absolutely doing it. And they just want to sit back and go, oh, he's the bad guy. I'm the good moral conservative. And I just find that game boring. I don't know. I think the internet has given us too many options. There's too much obvious truth out there now to sit back and watch people play these games.
What amazes me is that a lot of our common friends who we would otherwise think are, you know, serious thinkers and measured thinkers and nuanced thinkers, the hysteria with which they tackle the Trump thing. And that's what I criticize, right? I mean, my background, my academic background is in psychology of decision making, right? And so I study rational behavior. I mean, literally as a mathematical axiomatic truth, what constitutes rational behavior, what constitutes irrational behavior. But more colloquially, when you say that someone is behaving irrationally, right, in the common language, parlance, well, I see some of these common friends that we have, and what I am amazed at is how non-measured their positions are, how hysteric, right? I mean, you could dislike a million things about Trump, and I might agree with you on a lot of them, but he's not outlawing sex. He is not rounding up the Jews and the people of color. And yet, so how do you explain? I mean, I try to explain it in my forthcoming book when I talk about idea pathogens and mind viruses. What's your take? Because you know the same people that I know that I'm talking about.
Yeah. I think a lot of it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it truly is just this initial part of they just want to kind of feel good about themselves. That Trump is the reverse of what a good liberal is supposed to be. And I don't mean that purely in terms of the ideas he holds. Trump is a blowhard. He is loud. He is a bit of a troll. He's orange and has crazy hair.
If I can interrupt you, the last time that I was on your show, I used the term, he is an aesthetic injury, right? He injures their sense of aesthetics, right? Obama is the opposite. Obama is lanky. He's got a mellifluous voice. He has a radiant smile. He speaks like a Southern Baptist preacher, right? So therefore, to use exactly this drink I'm doing, there's an expression in Arabic where simply smelling the drink gets you drunk. And that's what Obama does, right? I just see him and I feel good because he is so majestic. Whereas Trump is this ogre. He's disgusting, to use their words. And therefore, that's what they focus on, the aesthetic injury. Does that sound right?
I think you're very right. I mean, look, there's something about Obama, like Obama just did this video to endorse Biden, which is so ridiculous. It's beyond imagination. And the fact that they're all backing this guy who obviously has the beginnings of dementia or some other cognitive stuff. And it's quite sad, actually, and depressing. And there's so much to say about what's happened with the Democrats and all that. But even when Obama did the video, it sort of feels like this is sort of an offshoot of what you're saying, and then I'll get back to it. You watch Obama now, and he feels very out of touch with what the left has become and what the liberals or whatever you want to call it have become, because, yes, he gets up there, and he still looks good, and you're right. The cadence is still good, and he's got nice teeth, and his clothes fit, and all that, and there's a sense that he loves his wife and all of those things. But that's just stuff that's on the surface. It's about what you do, not what you say and what you look like and the rest of it. And I would argue that actually, in many ways, Trump has done a lot of the things that I would say classically liberal or sort of more libertarian-minded people have wanted to happen all along. You know, one of the things that I'm actually really super proud about this book is that you know how long the publishing process takes. So I finished this book in July of 2019. We're now at the end of April, early May of 2020. We edited it in the fall, and then I was done with it by Thanksgiving. So I haven't touched this thing for about 6 months now. So many of the ideas that I put forth in this book are now suddenly being discussed for the first time in God knows how long. States' rights, which nobody talks about in the United States, even though it's one of our most precious founding principles. The idea that we have this endless experiment of the states deciding what they want to do so we can figure out what's best and where to high taxes work, to legalizing alcohol work, you know, like all of these different tests. And I really write about that in this, and now it's coming around. But to sort of bring this back to the liberals, I think that there's a visceral thing that you're talking about, and they really can't get over it. But also part of the problem, and we've talked about this many times, when you take the craziest position about somebody, it's very hard to reel that back. So this was the danger, and I was saying this when I was still a lefty. Way before, you know, I knew you or any of this stuff, I was saying, guys, as I was waking up to it, I was saying, guys, meaning my side, the liberals, the lefties, if we keep calling this guy Hitler and all of his supporters Nazis, which of course is just absurd on its face and actual cultural appropriation and truly offensive if you want to take offense to things, it's not what you're doing to them. It's what you're doing to yourself, because you can't walk that back. And there's a video that I did literally the day after the election, the day after Trump got voted in, where I said, you know, the real problem here is we might find out that this guy lowers taxes, that the economy is pretty good, that we don't go to extra wars. You know, and I laid out a few things that I would view as positive things, you know, regulation gets pulled back, et cetera. Now, let's just remove Corona from this for a second, because for the economy purposes. But basically, that is what's happened. We're not going to extra wars. There's a sense that we actually are, I think, rejiggering alliances that have made the world actually seem kind of safer. Until Corona, the economy was hot, and I know we will get over this, and it will get back, maybe not to exactly where it was, but I'm completely hopeful for the future. But when you say all of these crazy things, that's Hitler that's doing it, you can't suddenly be like, oh, you know, that Hitler guy, he's actually doing a pretty decent job.
Right.
So you have to double down again and again and again. And I'll just tell you one more story about this. So someone that we know years ago, remember, it's like so many things have happened with Trump that it's hard to remember what happened when. But remember, you know, there was the Russia thing and the Ukraine thing and Michael Cohen and all of this stuff. And do you remember at one point, this is probably 2 years ago now, it feels like a lifetime ago, there was this thing about that Trump Jr. had lunch with someone that was Russian on the Upper East Side. And so I got a call from somebody we know basically screaming at me that I haven't hit Trump enough and that this is the smoking gun. This is the smoking gun. His son had dinner or lunch on the Upper East Side with a Russian. And guess what? It all turned into nothing. It all turned into nothing. So again, I don't mean this to throw anyone under the bus or attack any of the people that we know and that in many ways I really do like. But I think there's an odd thing, and I think in some respects, me and you, for being a little more honest about it, for saying, oh, you know, these conservatives aren't as evil as we always painted them to be, maybe, or that really our side does have bigger problems than we've wanted to acknowledge. It has come at a, I would say, a personal cost and a social cost.
Oh.
I don't mind paying that cost because I know I'm doing what I think is right, but it's not nothing. You know what I mean?
Listen, try to be in academia and take the positions, right? But, you know, I always say, and people ask me, well, you know, what motivates you to take the positions that you do? What, I mean, is it that you have such courage? I say, no, actually, the thing that motivates me is that I have a very high standard of personal conduct, or sort of a moral conscience. When I go to bed at night and I lay my head on the pillow, I need to feel as though I was fully true to myself. And therefore, my quote, big mouth is really a reflection of that. In other words, I can't see something that I consider to be an injury to truth and not speak out. So it's not because I'm courageous or it's literally because I'm revolted at, and that's what you see. That's, for example, when I interact on Twitter, some people love that style. Other people say, oh, it diminishes you, professor, which of course is an idiotic thing because that makes it seem as though the only way that one should be a professor is to be highfalutin, be smoking a pipe, right? They don't realize that there is a thing called behavioral plasticity, right? The way I act when I tuck my children to bed is different than the way I act if I were mugged in an alley. The fact that I would react violently when I'm mugged in an alley doesn't make me violent. It makes me someone who is responding to the situation at hand. So when I'm dealing with a whole bunch of cretins and imbeciles and lobotomized fools on Twitter and I respond harshly, it's not because I'm a nasty or mean guy, because most people who meet me in person know that I'm very sweet and gentle and funny and so on, but it's because I genuinely get offended by this garbage.
Yeah, it's funny because I have some version of that myself where, you know, something will come out of me on Twitter and then I'll go, ah, that's not the best version of myself. But, you know, not all of us can be the best version of ourselves all the time. Well, first off, nobody can be, right? You simply can't. I mean, you know, that way you would be almost superhuman to always be
And you wouldn't be true, right?
If you modulate
yourself, right? Whatever you see me do is not me being, you know, unthinking. It's really me. Look, you come at me with an insult. If you catch me on a bad day, I roll up my sleeves with a smile on my face and I start trolling you until you close your Twitter account, because I don't modulate. I'm not trying to pretend that I am above it. That's why I say I'm a professor of the people. I'm down to earth. Anyways, go ahead.
It's so interesting because actually what you're saying, I think in many ways mirrors sort of how Trump behaves with the media,
exactly.
Right? He, when he does these things, it's so interesting because I see a lot of this now where there's a lot of ex-lefties, liberals, let's say, that are like, you know what, I'm done with the Democrats and all that. But they still have this sort of very aversion to Trump. They have this feeling that he can't control it or something like that. And what I always say to them is, look, I don't love the guy. You know what I mean? Like, it's not something like that. Like, would I prefer that we had Thomas Jefferson as president? Probably. You know, that might be a little bit better. Of course, he was a slave owner and there's a whole problem there. But putting that aside, would I personally rather that we lived in a society that valued sort of free thought a little bit more and decorum a little bit more and all of those things? Of course I would. That doesn't happen to be the society that we live in now. And when Trump attacks, it's like I find it hard to – people will say, Dave, you don't criticize him enough. And it's like I have trouble criticizing the guy who did the thing that everyone said couldn't be done.
Right.
He did it his way. The Republicans tried it the other way. Like, by most accounts, pretty much everyone would say that John McCain and Mitt Romney, you might have political differences with them, but that you would say that they're decent humans. Probably you would. And it's like they tried it being decent. But the thing is, when a Republican's facing a Democrat, it's not just an even boxing match. It's that a Republican's facing the Democrats and the media and,
right.
and the academic establishment and the cultural establishment and all that. So they tried it the other way. It didn't work. Trump saw that, I think, and he was like, forget this. I'm not playing by their rules. I'm going to do whatever I want. So every now and again, when I see one of his tweets about, you know, obsessing over ratings or fighting with some random person or whatever, yeah, is my initial reaction like, ugh, could the president of the United States not do that? Of course that's my feeling. But then on the other hand, it's like He knows what got him there because he didn't listen to any of the advisors. So now all the people that want him to behave differently, it's like maybe he does know something and it's a scary thing to know and you're a little bit afraid to know it. It's something like that.
One last point on Trump, and then I want to come back to the process of how you wrote your book. Victor Davis Hanson, whom I think you know who that is, right?
I haven't had him on yet, but he's on our master list.
Oh, yes. Likewise. The more I've gotten to know him, I truly do find him to be a very measured thinker, a very deep thinker. What I love is his ability to link contemporary issues to ancient Greece, precisely because he is a classicist. And in one of the podcasts that I listened to him, he was talking about the tragic hero from Greek mythology. And I can't remember the name of the character, but that this was the guy who, sort of was desperate to receive accolades and credit for the good work that he was doing. And the more that he wasn't receiving it, the more he would be outlandish. And he linked it to Trump, right? I mean, Trump is a narcissist in that, well, most politicians are, right? Otherwise, you probably wouldn't get into that racket. And he does want to receive credit. And it drives him crazy when he does good things. I'm not saying he always does only good things.
Right.
But any decent and fair person would say, okay, here is something that he's done that is objectively good, but he could never catch a break. And that triggers him not in the woke sense, but in the more general sense of the term. And therefore, he does that tweeting. Look at me. I did something good. Give me credit, daddy. Please pay attention to me. It's a character flaw, but anyone who is mature enough to understand it recognizes where it's coming from, right?
You might find this interesting very quickly. Do you know Jerome Harzoni, who wrote The Virtue of Nationalism? Does the name ring a bell?
No.
Really, really interesting thinker. He's an Orthodox Jew, conservative, lives in Jerusalem. I think he has 12 children, but he wrote a really brilliant book called The Virtue of Nationalism, which the main argument is that you want strong nations to then come together. That would be globalism in its right sense. You don't want some massive global power to tell all the countries what to do. That's a very short version of it. But he's Orthodox Jew and he's a Trump supporter from what I can tell. And I had dinner with him one night and I said to him, how can you, a man that seems to be very pious to me, you care about honesty and decency and all of these things, how can you support Trump? And he actually told me a biblical story, which I don't remember all the names. There were a lot of fancy names in there. But it was about a time of deep, deep, deep corruption. And the only guy who could fix that deep corruption was the most corrupt guy. Because then all the other corrupt people could turn and say, he's worse than us.
Right.
And he could actually rise through that and ultimately do good despite the corruption. So I don't know that it's the perfect parable, but I think there's something to it.
Very nice.
But enough about Trump.
Okay, let's go back to your book. Now, what I'm interested, a lot of the content of your book is stuff that we would have either already just discussed or have discussed in the past. What I'm interested is in the mechanics. This was your first book, hopefully not your last. What was your, because I often receive emails from either graduate students or aspiring authors asking me, how is it to write a book, professor? What are some tips? So take us through your journey. What were some of the things that you found particularly easy? Some of the things that you found very challenging? Give us your process.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that question because it's not the normal question you get asked when you're talking about your book. So first off, I'll tell you, I enjoyed the process way more than I thought I was going to. When I signed the deal, so we got the deal when I was on tour with Jordan Peterson and we were in Dublin.
Sorry, who was the person you said?
When I was on tour with Jordan Peterson.
Never heard of this guy. Who is it?
Oh, you've never heard Jordan Peterson. He's a little known Canadian psychologist.
Okay,
you'll hear
I'll
about
him.
One day.
I check him out. Sounds interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah. My agent called me and they said, we got a couple offers and they want you to write this book. And originally, I mentioned this right at the top of the book, they wanted me to write a book called Why I Left the Left. And the deal that I signed, on the deal, it said that the title of the book was Why I Left the Left. And a few days later, we were in Oslo. That's when I actually signed the deal. And I'll just quickly tell you something about that little known Jordan Peterson guy. It was 5 minutes before the show, the Oslo show. We did two in Oslo. It was one of the biggest theaters that we had done, about 6,000 people, literally just moments before the show. I get the text that I got the deal. I walk into his, David was with me on that leg of the tour, walk into his dressing room. He's there with his wife, Tammy. I said, Jordan, I just got incredible news. I got a deal from Penguin Random House, blah, blah, blah. And he just exploded in joy. The biggest smile you could possibly imagine. He was sitting in a swivel chair. He slapped his hands. He spun around in the chair. He got up, big hug, immediately said, he goes, "Would it be too forward if I asked you if I could write the forward?"
Oh, that's lovely.
I said, "Jordan, that would probably be okay." Then unfortunately, because of everything that's happened in the last year, he didn't write the forward, but he did write a lovely blurb on the front and a more extended one on the back. And the only thing I can add to that is that he will be back and better than ever. It's just going to take a little time. And I saw him a few months ago and he'll get there.
Let me share, before you go on, excuse me, because you mentioned, let me mention my own heartwarming recent Jordan story. I mean, I've got many, of course, because I obviously I also know him very well. I reached out to him to seek his endorsement and so on for the book. And I was very tepid because I obviously knew the situation that he was in. I wasn't sure if it would be too gauche for me to be contacting him but I didn't know exactly where he was in the recovery process. And so he writes back right away to me, says, "This is the first day that I'm actually doing well enough to be typing on a laptop." And then he writes a unbelievable endorsement and then says, I hope that this is okay. Let me know if it's fine." And then the love fest between us. And that shows you, so for the Jordan haters, that shows you what kind of guy he is. So
look, this is a guy who went through, I mean, try to imagine what the last couple of years of this guy's life, and chapter 9 in the book is about find a mentor. And I talk about being on tour with him for a year or a year and a half, really. I mean, not only the incredible fame, but the amount of hit pieces, the amount of hate, the amount of protests, the amount of threats, the amount of love that we would get at airports and wherever we were, that people would come up to him. And it's not just like, he's not just like a celebrity, like, "Oh, I love your movie," or an athlete, like, "Oh man, I remember that shot." It's more like, "You turned my life around. I'm not on drugs anymore. I solved the problem with my wife. I gave up this, I'm doing this, I have a better job." I mean, I saw every version of that imaginable. And then in the midst of the tour, he finds out that his wife has terminal cancer. I was at lunch with him, I think we were in Iowa, and when he got the call, he was on the phone with the doctor and his wife, and I heard the beginning of it, and then I left the table because I wanted him to have some privacy. But just the insane tumult and of every human emotion that someone could have.
Unreal.
Who, by the way, never asks for it. You know, it's not like, he's like you. He's an academic first, and he had a clinical practice. This isn't someone that sought fame, per se. It presented itself, and he took the opportunity. But back to the book. So I got the deal, and I was supposed to write Why I Left the Left. And I was writing it for about 3 weeks, and I kept feeling that I was writing against ideas, not for ideas. I was writing about all the things that I don't like anymore that I've talked about. You know, I only said the word regressive once in the book. People say I say regressive, I don't know if I've said it 3 times in the last 2 years, but I used to say regressive left a lot, obviously. Which, by the way, for the record, as I say in the book, Majid Nawaz was the one who came up with it first. Everyone seems to think I did, but I give credit where it's due. But I realized I was writing about things that I was against and not things that I was for. So I called the guys at Penguin and I said, "Listen, I don't think this is the book I want to write. I want to write a book about classical liberalism, about what it's been like for me to sort of survive the mob and be someone who has tried to fix some of the conversation along the way, what I've learned from some of the people that I've talked to and how I've navigated and really give people a roadmap to think for themselves, to say, okay, I don't have to be a lefty on every freaking issue and I don't have to be a conservative on every issue. Pick a thing. You know, your feelings on gay marriage shouldn't necessarily dictate your feelings on taxes. But for some reason, we think that these things are true." And they love the idea. They immediately let me switch it, or accepted that I was going to switch it. And I will tell you, in terms of the process, I find I'm at my best sort of mentally the second I wake up, and I can go as long as I can until I can't go anymore. So basically, I would get up every morning. This was when Emma, our previous dog, was still alive, and she was really in her last days, and she had cancer, and she was 16, and you know how much I loved her. I'd get her outside for a little bit, make my coffee, then we'd go into the green room, because this is my house, my studio's in my house, as you know, and so I don't really technically have an office, but I turned the green room, which is one of the bedrooms, into my office. Emma would just lay down by my feet. I'd get there with my laptop, And I would just go and go and go. And often, suddenly it would be, you know, if I started at 8 a.m., it would be 2 or 3 p.m., and I hadn't eaten or anything. Sometimes David would literally open the door, and like as if I was in solitary confinement, he would slide a plate of food in, because he knew he didn't want to bother me, but he would literally just make something and hope that I would eat it, just a plate, you know, sandwich on a plate or some eggs or something, just hope that I would eat it. And then I would go, and then at some point, usually around 2 or 3, I just had nothing left. And one of the things that I'm most proud of, actually, is that, you know, this is my first book, and my editor said to me that the amount of clean writing that I gave her, that she was actually really shocked that we didn't have a ton of editing to do. We moved things. So, she, you know, what I thought, which I didn't know was that common. She said to me right at the beginning, you might find that chapter 1 becomes chapter 9 and 4 becomes 2. And sure. So she did move a few things like that, because it's a little bit like putting together a Lego set. But I really enjoyed it. You know, more than anything else, I think it made me, you know, it's one thing to interview people. It's one thing to talk. It's one thing to tweet. There's an immediacy to all of that, where it's like you do it and it goes away. And even if the mob comes after you, the mob eventually goes away. So it's not something that just like kind of lives forever. But I was very aware that when I was writing this, like, this is here. Like, yeah, maybe yeah. some people will burn it. And if they do burn it, I hope they put it on Twitter so I can retweet them. But I wanted to write something that would be as relevant 5 years from now as it was. So I really enjoyed having to churn through the ideas that I was talking about. And really, what do I really, really think about abortion now? What do I really, really think about taxes? And can I get these things that, you know, there are books, hundreds, if not thousands of books written about abortion alone. But could I condense into 5 pages a primer for people so that if they want to explore more, they can find other books, but I'll have given them some sensible ways of looking at the issues. And that's really what I tried to do, and I enjoyed it. Way more than I thought I would, truly.
You know, so in my case, of course, there are 2 forms of writing that I engage in. Oh, here's my gorgeous wife with round
Again?
2. With round 2. Thank you,
round
sweetie.
Round 2. Oh my, look at you, and little white wine.
Thanks, love. I'm good. No more, because I won't be able to speak to him. I'm very, you know, for a guy who's over 200 pounds, I'm very, very lightweight when it comes to alcohol. Like, I'll finish this one, and I'll start seeing double. I mean, literally, I have very little tolerance.
I'm trying to remember, when we had you and your wife and your kids over for dinner about a year ago, did you drink?
I don't even know. Very little, because I wanted to do this. Very little. I'm very measured. Yeah. So cheers.
Well, cheers, my friend.
Before we go on, I wish you the best of success with your book. I'm sure it's going to be a smash hit.
And yours as well, which I know comes out in the fall.
In October, yeah.
In October. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, I guess, all right, I'll have you on one more time.
Okay, thanks. So what I was going to say is, so there are two forms of writing that I do. There's, of course, the journal paper, the academic paper. Now there, the specific content is going to be different from paper to paper, because you're dealing with a different research question. But the template of the paper is the same, right? There is the introduction of the problem, there is the literature review, there's the stating the hypotheses and the research question, here's the methodology that we used, now we collected the data, here are the data analyses, here are the conclusions, right? So the template of the story that you're telling doesn't change much from paper to paper. On the other hand, when you're writing a book, it's a completely different process, because yes, you may have a general roadmap. So I start with the idea of, here are 9 major things I want to say, probably in each of different chapters. But then as you start drilling down and filling in those many, many holes, you go on paths and journeys that you didn't know a priori. And it's really kind of a mystical process. I kind of view it as, you know, I'm not much of a meditation guy. I know that our common friend Sam Harris is a bit, and I'd love to see if I can get into meditation, because sometimes I'm overstressed. But I view writing as a form of kind of metaphysical, intellectual, because I go into a cave, I'm so in flow, I'm so in another world, that when I come out, like just like you said, you forget to eat, right? When I come out of it, it's as if I've had a religious experience. Did you feel some of that? Do you get what I'm saying?
Well, the way I described it was, when I handed in that first manuscript at the end of July, and as you know, I do my August off the grid thing, where I have no phone, no television, no news, no nothing for a month.
You don't cheat? You never cheat on that?
I do not cheat.
Wow.
I do not cheat.
That's impressive.
Which which, by the way, is incredibly, it's becoming harder and harder.
Yeah.
Well, A, because, you know, as my profile, I suppose, has increased, people come up to me on the streets. And what's funny is sometimes people will want to say something to me, but they know not to. But there were other times where I would be at the gym. Now, first off, to avoid televisions at the gym is very difficult because there's CNN is everywhere. If there's a muted television, CNN is on. So if I was doing cardio at the gym, I had to have a low hat and kind of like this. But people would truly keep me honest. There was a guy who came up to me several times at the gym who said, Dave, come on. I know you have your phone on you. I know you have. And I'd have to take out my pockets and go, no. No phone on me. So, yes, I don't cheat at all. I have the luck. Look, I have an assistant now, and I have people that work for me that are able to keep the operation going. Right. So I have some luxuries there. And it's not that I'm not working per se. It's not like I'm on vacation for a month because I was also writing some other stuff and doing some other things. But I'm not looking at screens, and just that in and of itself and taking a break. And guess what? You find out at the end of every August, I find out the same thing. Boy, I didn't miss that much. You know, life goes on. But yeah. But to your point about meditation and sort of this sort of otherworldly experience when you're writing this, when I handed in the manuscript at the end of July, I remember I sent it to Helen, my editor, and I turned to David and I said, that must feel like what it's like to give birth.
Exactly. Now,
I know in 2020 that men can give birth. So I now know that I know what it feels like to give birth. But then the funny part of that is, so then you kind of forget about it. And that's why I wanted to have it done by July so I could let my brain sort of reset and recalibrate throughout August. But then September rolls around and now we have to edit. And all I kept thinking was, boy, I just gave birth to this thing. And what's the first thing you do to the thing you gave birth with? Now you have to operate on it. And that's a very weird feeling, yeah. Right? Because suddenly you're like, oh, I did it. I can put it away. I enjoyed it, but it's a lot of work. It's a lot of days just, you know, crunched. I don't even have a proper desk in there. I have a coffee table. So I'm sitting on my laptop. My back was hurting a lot. And it's like, I wanted to put that behind me. And then you come back and now you've got to edit. And next thing you know, it's like, oh, and here's the brains are over here and the liver is over here. And you got to operate and put that thing back together, which, you know, I didn't love the editing process. I can tell you that much. I didn't love it because I don't really love the technical part of it that much. But the overall experience was wonderful. And hopefully this thing will do pretty well and I'll do another one.
Well, the analogy to giving birth is actually very apt because when I wrote my first book, which came out in 2007, which was an academic book, so a very technical, very scientific book written for other academics, I was so much in my cave, right? For example, The Consuming Instinct, a later book, was written for a mass audience. That's a different style, right? So to push the giving birth analogy further, I actually felt that I was suffering from a form of postpartum depression. And I couldn't exactly explain why that was. I felt very empty. I felt like there was a hole because I think it took about 16 or 17 months of, you know, 10-hour days to write the first draft of that book. And then you wake up and there isn't that drive. The book is out in the world. And so I think that's a really great analogy, the giving birth analogy.
Well, you know, it's also funny because we all have our own different ways about doing things, right? This is what's unique about humans. So Jordan, when I got the deal, he said, we sat down for dinner one night and he said, you know, you may want to consider having three screens in front of you. He said, I usually have a manuscript screen that I'm putting the best quality sentences into, and I have an editing screen and I'm rewriting each sentence. I think he said 12 times, you know, and I knew I could never do anything that highly technical. And also, you know, Maps of Meaning, of course, which was Jordan's first book, and then 12 Rules for Life. These are seriously, seriously dense idea books. And again, I wanted to give people something that they could read in a couple of days, take some pieces. And then what I really want, even if it hurts sales, is I want people to give this book to somebody. I want them to go, whoa, you know, I've seen something wrong with the world. I know you kind of see it too. This won't take you 5 weeks to read. You can knock this out in a couple of days and not feel bludgeoned by all the ideas. And I'm not saying that's what Jordan's doing and those other things, but they're denser reads.
Yeah.
That's important in another way, right? Like there's all sorts of books. People write dense books. They write sort of softer books. Everyone has their own style. But that's actually the cool part of doing this. And I have to say more than anything else, you know, I have all these books on my set.
Yeah.
from all every book that's on my set is from an author or a thinker, philosopher, whatever, someone that I like and that I've had on the show. And the fact that, you know, I have something that like fits in this thing now.
It's amazing.
It does feel like something to me. It really does.
You know, we did that test show. Your parents finally love you and take you seriously?
Finally, I will get some parental approval, so now I can quit.
Right. I was going to say that one of the things that when people ask me, can you give us some tips about how to be, you know, good authors, I tell, because you were talking about, oh, you didn't get you didn't face a lot of editing. There wasn't too much rewrites and so on. So I think there is a danger when you are so attached to every word that you've written because you've toiled over every, you can exactly remember that afternoon where you were in your study for 4 hours, but you've only produced 3 sentences. And then my wife comes back and says, so what have you done? I say, well, here are the 3 sentences I did. She's like, that's what you've been doing for the whole afternoon. That's what you've come up with. That's it. So you know how much you've struggled sometimes on a particular sentence or idea. Then you get your editor who comes and says, I'd like you to remove this section, right? So the first reaction you might have,
yep,
which is the one of non-humility, is no, you don't touch a syllable. And it certainly could be something that I could succumb to because I'm so attached to everything. But you have to step back and have the humility to say, wait a second, I think that if I have tasked this person as part of the process to yes. read my work, I have to be humble enough to listen to what they say. And I've always kept that in the back of my head because invariably when they've given me feedback, it has only improved the final product.
That might be the most important part of this. If as a first-time author, I could impart wisdom on anyone, I think you just nailed it right there, is that hopefully, you know, whatever your publishing house is, has given you an editor that has some basic understanding of who you are. One of the things that I really like is my editor, Helen, she's a young girl in her 20s. And, you know, at first, I didn't know her, obviously, before we were just put in a room together and they said, have at it. But, you know, you have to do a little dance together to kind of figure out, does she view the world sort of as I do? And is that important? Is it possible that maybe could she have been a social justice warrior? And could she have edited effectively? Right. And I think we evolved and worked through the issues together, which was really, really interesting. One of the other things that you have to also remember is that when you get that galley copy out, which is the one that's going to go to the press and all that, and it's an unfinished, unfully edited copy, that's just the way the business works, that there's going to be some mistakes in there. And they always put, I don't have the galley, I have the galley copy over there, but there's always a, you know, a marker or a sticker on the front that says, you know, not for publication and not for press review, the unfinished version. And there was a moment in the book, in the galley copy that went out, where I had, as you can imagine, you know me, there were a couple Star Wars references in the book. And when I did my last pass through, I was like, you know, maybe there's just one too many Star Wars references. So I changed a Star Wars reference to a Transformers reference because, Gad, you know, I'm a pretty elitist guy, so I'm doing the high level stuff over here. Except I didn't change the punchline; I only changed the premise. So I have a star in the galley copy that went out to press. I have a Star Wars beginning of a joke with a Transformers ending of a joke that anyone in their right mind that knows me would go, did he have an aneurysm as he was writing this, you know? When it went out to the press, I was like, oh, God, that's what they were going to get me on. But then you have to have people behind you and the people at Penguin that said, well, look, if they go to press with this to attack you over this silly joke, technically they've actually gone against what our agreement as a publishing house is with the press because they're not supposed to.
To release it, yeah.
We send a letter in there saying you should wait to review this till you have the final copy because some of these things have changed. But anyway, all of that, it's a learning process like anything else. You know, it's like if you were switching careers tomorrow and you were an accountant, you'd probably have to learn a little bit of something.
Yeah,
math, for example.
Speaking of galley proofs, so one of the things that stresses me the most in the process of writing a book or writing papers, because of my maladaptive perfectionism,
a good title for a book.
Yeah,
maladaptive perfectionism.
There you go. So usually when a author receives the galley proofs, it's the last step. So you should be kind of overjoyed. This is your final chance to kind of go over everything, make sure that all the T's are crossed, all the I's are dotted, and then you're done. In my case, it's actually a terribly anxiety-inducing moment, because it is the last time that I'll be able to check, and yeah. God forbid, or Darwin forbid, that there would ever be an error, even a banal error, a typo that I don't pick up. So I literally am overwhelmingly anxious when I'm going through the galley proofs, because I am so concerned about even the... Now, I think that that's... The reason why I call it maladaptive perfectionism is because I think, you know, to be perfectionist to some degree is good, because that means you're attentive, you're attention oriented, right? You're detail oriented, right? You care about your work. But if you are spending 7 days going over the galley proofs to be able to intercept one comma that's out of place, then maybe even if that comma was out of place and you had spent your time doing something else for those 7 days, so I think I'm on the, you know, non-productive end of the curve. How is it for you? Are you as perfectionist as me, or are you in the more healthy range?
If that's what we're calling healthy, I'm probably in the more healthy range, but that also may be a function of that this was my first book. So every time something was presented to me, it was my first time hearing about it, that this is how the process works. So there would be times where I would send something back and then she would send me something and there would still be errors and I'd be freaking out. And then she'd be like, no, we'll get to that. You know, like, this is just sort of how you churn through all of this stuff. But I'll tell you this, one of the things that I had no idea is that when they do like a first run on a book, so right now we have X amount of books published for that first run. I always thought when you go to a bookstore and you see, oh, second edition, third edition, something like that, I didn't realize that meant there could be tiny technical changes or a sentence that was switched a little bit. I always thought that meant, oh, the author added something, like they must have added something at the end, or, you know, I printed this in 1987, it's now 2003, here's what's happened since, something like that. I didn't realize that second edition often means the print finished, and now because we're going to print more, we can actually make a few more adjustments.
Right.
So we know already when I did the audiobook, which I really loved doing the audiobook.
You did it in your voice?
I did it in my own voice. Okay. I wanted Betty White, but she was unavailable. But I did it right as Corona was starting. So it was right as the streets were clearing out and, you know, nobody was anywhere. And I was driving to Hollywood, and that's where the studio was, because we wanted to use a true, you know, the true audio booth, not my set here, which is soundproof, but not like, you know, it's not like that little padded cell kind of thing. And I was driving there and there were nobody on the streets. And I thought, I'm going to always remember this, that when I was doing my audiobook, it was the beginnings of this, you know, crazy pandemic. I certainly didn't think that 6 weeks later we'd still be in the midst of it. But that idea that once I was in the booth and I would be reading something and I'd go, you know, now that I read it out loud in my own inflection, in my own intonation, maybe I do want to adjust this little word. So I still, for the next version of this, I've got about 20. I would say I have about 20. Most of them are just slight word changes or slight phrase changes. And all that technical stuff. Yeah, I probably don't go as crazy as you on that, on the perfection side. And that may just be a function of you have an academic discipline that you, I think, probably have to, you can't make an error on the margins in some of the papers you've written, I'm sure, where... For what I do, there's a little more give and take, a little more play.
No, you're right. For example, if you're reporting a statistical finding, putting a plus where a minus should have been completely changes. And so I will literally spend, literally on the border of OCD, where I check the table 650 times, right? Because I'm, God forbid, that it gets published, and then I realize, oh shit, that number should have been 4.8, not 5.8, and maybe that. Yeah. So it's the, and I truly believe that it has affected. I mean, although I'd like to think that I've been very productive in my career, I think it. I would have been a lot more productive had I been in the healthier range of checking and double checking. By the way, it's also caused me to not sometimes collaborate with people, because I'm worried that they won't have the exacting standards that I do. And therefore, let's say you and I are going to work together and I get the feeling that you may be careless with details, then I'd rather avoid having an extra paper that doesn't meet my, which again is kind of silly, because I've lost the opportunity to be on 20, 30 additional papers because of a brutally exacting standard.
I guess what you have to do more than anything else is you have to also surround yourself with the right people.
Exactly.
So hopefully, you know, in your case, I don't know how involved maybe your wife gets in some of the ideas, or if you come back to her and churn through some of the stuff. I actually, you know, David is the executive producer of the show, as you know, and for the first time after we built this thing together, and for the first time after now, you know, something like 8 years of doing it, we're actually considering phasing him out, because we've taken it as far as it can go together. It can keep moving, but he wants to now explore some different things. But what I'm really proud of, actually, in these last years, look, when we met that first time at Aura TV, when we did that test show, I was working for another network. I was renting an apartment. I didn't have my own home where I now have a studio. I didn't have my own production company. I now also have a tech company. I started this locals.com situation. But it's not that I just did that in a vacuum. It's that over the years, I somehow have consistently surrounded myself with some pretty good people, or I would say at least since my wake up. So at least since right around when we met, the director that I have, the associate producer that I have, my producers, when we've brought on production assistants, our graphics people, everyone right now, we treat everybody great, and they always have my back. My assistant makes sure I am where I'm supposed to be. And I mention this all because by having the right people around you, you can actually clear a lot of the clutter out of your brain so that you can focus on the idea, the writing, and all of that stuff. If I had, you know, I've actually removed myself from a lot of the day-to-day operation of the Rubin Report, other than that I have to interview somebody and know what I'm doing and all that. But in terms of scheduling, in terms of all our technical stuff and all that, in a way, it's like I need to not have anything to do with that now if I'm going to be able to sort of do interviews and interview other people and hopefully eventually get on a book tour when the world opens up again and the rest of it. So having a right team around you in life, I think, is as key as almost anything else.
A couple of more questions, because I am mindful of your time. I know you have to go in less than 10 minutes. Question one, I want to say that I regret that I wasn't able to join you on part of your book tour. You were gracious enough to invite me for a few of the venues, but a virus thought otherwise. So hopefully we'll have a chance to rekindle some of those joint venues at some future date.
I'm sure we will. And we're going to work on a separate Canadian tour. You know, we have a separate Canadian publisher also.
Right.
So,
but you know that I can fly outside of Canada, right? You know,
I thought maybe you were not allowed. I don't know.
They do let me out once in a while outside of Canada.
All right. Well, we'll consider it.
Good. The second thing I want to ask you, so earlier you mentioned that, you know, when someone intercepts you at the gym and the fame and so on, how have you handled? Obviously, your profile has become much larger, much bigger, as has mine. Of course, in the case of someone like Jordan, it was really like a meteoric rise, right? I mean, it wasn't just sort of incrementally, right? He went from no one's ever heard of him for 30 years to he's Lady Gaga, right? So, I mean, not in the sense of being silly, in the sense of fame, right?
Yeah, of course.
What are the things that you enjoy about fame? Are there any things that you dislike? Because I also have my own thoughts in terms of my own reality.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Look, I'm not going to sit here and say that I don't have an ego, or that I didn't want any of this, or that being recognized isn't nice, or any of that stuff. It is all nice. And, you know, it's so interesting because, you know, we deal with so much hate online all the time. But one of the things that you find is in real life, everybody. I think I've maybe had one person ever be rude to me.
I haven't even had that.
Yeah, well, I'm not even, and the reason I said I think is I'm not even quite sure if he was being rude to me or he was just nervous, so it came out kind of stumbly bumbly. But that's the point, is that in real life, now that's not to say I haven't been at a supermarket and maybe somebody that I didn't realize hated me and was giving me the evil eye from the back. But anyone that comes up to me anywhere, if it's the supermarket or a movie theater or on the street when I'm walking my dog or whatever, they only have the nicest things to say. You know, they'll say, you allowed me to start thinking about some things a little bit differently and the rest of it. A lot of times they'll say mostly nice things about Jordan, and then they'll say something nice about me too. So I get a little of that afterglow, which is kind of funny. There's a girl at the local hardware store who for years we had a running joke because I was checking out and she said to me, she goes, Dave Rubin, I'm a big fan. I was like, oh, thanks. She's like, I'm a big fan, but I really like that Ben Shapiro. And like, so all these kind of funny things. Right. And what's cool about it, I think, really, is that, you know, Gad, we're not actors. So it's like, you don't really know. Look, Ben Affleck, you know, he said they're gross and racist, but he's an actor. You don't know what he really thinks about anything. But you could walk up to an actor and say, I really enjoyed you in Batman. I really enjoyed you in this, that, the other thing. For whatever it is that we have in the public sphere right now, this whole new crew of people that have sort of grown out of, partly out of academia, but partly out of comedy, partly out of writing or whatever it is, but through YouTube, through podcasts, it's like these people really do know us. I'm not worried that someone's going to come up to me on the street and it's going to be very different, or I'll have to act differently or present myself differently or something like that.
It's amazing.
And it is, it's really cool. Look, I'm not going to say that there's nothing negative to it. I have cameras all around my house. We have a big fence outside. I've had death threats and a lot of unpleasant stuff. So absolutely that is, it just is. But look, at the end of the day, if you're going to do something that you believe in, and if you're going to try to say something true and make mistakes along the way and hopefully have some wins along the way, like, you're going to have haters, you're going to have lovers and all of it. I do view the fame part, it's sort of like a necessary byproduct, I suppose, you know?
Yeah, I was just going to just add to my my answer to my own question. It's the same as you. We all have an ego in that we're ultimately doing this because we want people to consume our product. And in this case, consuming our product is buying our books, watching our clips, not because we're narcissistic, but because we are in the marketplace of ideas. And therefore, if people are buying our ideas, I mean, literally or figuratively, then we are doing exactly what we were hoping to achieve. So that's all good. And it's wonderful. I've had millions of people come up to me all the time. And even in incredibly obscure places, I could be on some remote beach in Bahamas and some Bahamian comes up to me who I thought, how does this guy know me? Right. But I do feel that even though, just like you, I mean, I've received a million death threats. I had to file reports with the Montreal police and I had to have security, but I've never had someone come up to me personally and be anything other than unbelievably polite and sweet and gracious. It does somehow cause, again, I don't want to go back to the word anxiety. Maybe that's not quite the correct clinical term. But the fact that you feel that where I almost now can pick out when I know someone is coming from the corner of my eyes because they're staring at my family too long. I see. So you become a bit defensive. Usually, in my case, that response comes because I'm with my family. If I were walking alone, I don't care that you come, but I always get a bit, not defensive towards the people coming up to me, but internally, I get a bit stressed because I start obsessing about, did they take pictures of my young children? Did they do? So I think for me, that's probably the only negative aspect of having become much more known is this kind of feeling that there could always be an intrusion on people, meaning my family, who didn't ask to be in this position. In my case, I'm doing it, right? It's me.
Yeah, it just is. And even if that feeling grew, and unless there was like some serious, unspeakable something, the idea that you wouldn't do what you're supposed to do on this earth because of that would be pretty scary and pretty anti-human, actually, because you're supposed to do what you're doing. But I've had so many interesting things, like just in the last few weeks, when we adopted Clyde, our new dog, I brought him on Fox News a couple times and on Dana Perino's show, and he was jumping on me. And then I'm walking down the street and a neighbor yells we have to socially distance, so he's on his side of the fence. But he yells, he goes, is that Clyde? Clyde and Dave Rubin? I can't believe it. And then we start chatting. And it turns out the guy went to the same high school as me in New York. We live in California now. And he was like this high-powered record executive. But he lived literally, he grew up a block away from me, 30 seconds away from my childhood home. And now we've become kind of friendly. So that's one of the interesting things now is because of Corona, I'm sure you're seeing some of this too. People are out and about more, and I've met more of my neighbors in the by name now in the last 5 weeks than I have in the previous 5 years. And it can be a little bit weird because people now know, they'll say, oh, I saw you on Tucker last night. And it's like, that means they know this is my studio and all that. And there is some weirdness there. But this is the life I chose. And it's been pretty damn good so far. To do a little version of like a Jordan kind of thing, it's like, when you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, life kind of moves correctly. And it doesn't mean you'll always move that way. We're all going to make mistakes along the way. We're all going to suddenly get into a Twitter spat and it's 3 hours later and you're like, what did I just expend all that energy on, or whatever it is. But I'm really, really trying right now. And maybe in some ways by being trapped in my house for the last 6 weeks, I've really been trying to eat right. I know you've been doing some exercise too, and you're always posting some pretty great food pictures also, but really trying to eat right. I've really been trying to exercise right and just kind of keep my mind and body knowing that I'm releasing this book and I'm sort of in the center of it right now, and you know, that center doesn't always stay there, and that hopefully I can give something decent to the universe, and I suspect it would give something decent back to me.
Amen. Two last things. Can we see Clyde very quickly?
Clyde stepped out, but let me see if we can get him. Get him in here.
Okay, number one. Number two, as you're doing this, we had promised the universe. Okay, you're texting David to bring in Clyde.
David to bring
That's
Clyde.
Very Hollywood. Like,
he's
going
to present him like Simba.
Very nice. We said that we would be doing this in swimsuits. Have you kept your end of the bargain, Ruben?
I kept my end of the bargain.
Stand up, let's see.
Oh, I'm attached to the chair here. Dad, have you ever...
Can you see
look
this?
Look at you.
Can you see it?
Look at you. Very impressive.
So here's to the crowd out there. If you think I sported my swim trunks better than Dave, please choose option one. Oh. And if you think I was better than Dave, please choose option two. Oh, my God. That might change my orientation.
Yeah. Beat that, Gad. Come on now.
It's in my lunchbox now. Hey, Dave, I wanted to – is Clyde coming? Because I know you have to go.
I don't know. David hasn't responded to me.
Okay.
They might be out for a walk.
So don't worry about it. We'll catch him.
Oh, wait. There he is. Can you bring Clyde in? Yeah. All right. Clyde's coming.
All right. I wanted to, again, raise my glass. I wish you infinite success with this book, brother. And I look
forward
to seeing you in California. I want to see Clyde before we leave.
All right. Clyde's going. All right, Clyde. Let's say hi to Gad Saad. Come here. Come here. It's so weird. It's so funny. I told you right before we started, he's so energetic, so crazy. All right, Clyde, you want this? Now you're going to be shy. Clyde, come on.
He has a bit of an Emma vibe.
He looks a lot like Emma.
He does. That's what
weird.
I mean.
Come on. Come on. Clyde, you're killing me. Bring him over here. Come on. Come on.
Yeah.
Clyde, Gad's sad.
Gad's sad. You have come a chance here. To meet me virtually and you're refusing? What
come
kind
on,
of insult
come
is
here.
This?
Wait, hold on, Gad. Come on. Clyde. This is unbelievable. Do I
he
need a treat? Oh, here we go. He's coming. Here we go. Come here. Clyde. Come here. This is literally hilarious. Wait, come here. Clyde.
I think I know why.
What? What's going on?
I pooped in Peter and Joel when I yelled at him.
Oh.
What's that?
I have just been informed that due to our crazy schedule that Clyde pooped in the control room.
Ooh.
So he's a little...
He's feeling as if you might get mad at him.
Clyde, it's okay. We've all done it. Everyone's pooped in the control room. Come here. Well, how about, does this suffice?
That's fine. This is Clyde by proxy. We'll end it there. Listen, let me turn off. I'll just say bye to you offline and then we'll wrap it up. Hold on a second.
Okay.
Okay, here we go.